John Rowe has gone elsewhere today. I think he's visiting his mother. Isn't that what he said? And he left me the assignment of 1 Samuel 20 and 21, the stories of David and Jonathan. Nick Cosmatis gave me a gift this morning for 2 weeks, not permanently. Manuscripts of the Greek Bible. Yeah. And I thought I'd just drop a advertisement here that in the next quarter, beginning in December, so it's another month away yet, we're going to have a study here in the auditorium of a Greek manuscript. A set of Greek manuscripts, and I just thought I'd let you know in advance. I think it's really very, very interesting. A few years ago, I gave a preliminary view of the Washington Codex, and I know we don't like stuff coming out of Washington these days, but this actually came out of Egypt. A codex which is the manuscripts of the four Gospels, of very early manuscripts, and it could be, and I'm going to give you the evidence for it when we get to that, could be that those are the autographs of the four Gospels that we have in our Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And so it's a very, very interesting and important study, and I think it strengthens our faith in what we have in the Bible, and I hope you'll be interested in that. And you don't have to know Greek in order to understand what I'm going to try to tell you. So Nick Cosmatis knows Greek, but he can sort of ride herd on us and make sure we teach the truth. But it's interesting. I taught this to a preliminary version of this one night to this congregation about 3 years ago, and most of you all have come since then. Half of the congregation is younger than 3 years now, so we're going to repeat that. But we're going to spread it out over a quarter and look into some details that tell us that these manuscripts are ancient and that they actually were handled by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So look forward to that. Today we're in the Old Testament. We're in 1 Samuel chapters 20 and 21, and we'll look at the details of the material as we go through it. And I try to follow the pattern that John Rowe has given you of giving you, first of all, a review. So last week, we saw in the story that we're following here that King Saul grew very jealous of David, didn't he? What led to that jealousy? Really, David's success, wasn't it? And also, Saul has known by this time that God doesn't approve of his being king, and he's on his way out, and he probably knows also that David is going to succeed him. But who would he want to succeed him? Jonathan, sure, his son, his oldest son. And so Saul determines to kill David so that Jonathan can inherit the throne. But Jonathan warns David, doesn't he, that Saul is after him. And so Saul sends men to capture David in his house, but who helps him to escape? His wife does, doesn't it? That's a good wife that would help warn you when your life is in danger. And she had rather see David escape than collect on his life insurance. So that's good, isn't it? Her name is Michal. And so she warns him, and how does she get him out of the house? He goes out through a back window, and the men that are coming to get him, she foils their attempt by saying, David is sick. And you can see he's in his bed, but what's in his bed? Well, some sort of an idol or something with goat hair. And I don't know if that fooled them or not, but they went away, went back, reported to Saul that David's sick. And what did Saul say? Bring him bed and all. We're not going to take any excuses. And Saul sends them to get him, but David's gone. And Saul finds out that David has gone where? Who's at Ramah? Samuel is at Ramah. And so David goes to Samuel at Ramah, and Saul finds out about that, and so he sends a group of men to capture him. And God thwarts that plan how? Those men, I don't think we actually got to look at that at the end of the lesson last time, but those men are caused to prophesy along with some prophets that they meet who are prophesying, and they prophesy too. And that thwarts their goal. And so he sends another group, and they do the same thing, and a third group, and they do the same thing. And finally, Saul goes to Ramah himself, and when he gets there, God treats him the same way, doesn't he? He falls on the ground prophesying. He can't function the way he intended. And so David gets away. He can't capture him. That reminds us of some other situations. When you read that last little bit in chapter 19, it says that the people said, is Saul also among the prophets? Remember, they see Saul on the ground prophesying. I don't know what that means, do you? He's uttering something that they recognize as prophecy, and there are a group of prophets there who are apparently saying the same thing. I don't know if he's uttering predictions or teachings or something that God is making him say. Now, you notice the bookends. What do we mean by bookends? Well, something at the beginning and something at the end, and it's this very thing. In 1 Samuel 10, at his anointing, Saul prophesied. That was one of the things that was predicted by Samuel that Saul would do. You recall that? And so that happened. And the people were astonished and said, is Saul also among the prophets? And then we have that here in chapter 19, in verse 24, after Saul determined to kill the Lord's anointed, that is David. Now remember, you're going to see that in the future lessons, that David will not kill Saul because he is the Lord's anointed. Well, David is the Lord's anointed too, isn't he? He's been already anointed to be the next king. Who did that? Okay, Samuel did that, didn't he? And Saul falls on the ground prophesying, is Saul also among the prophets? How is this significant? The first time that God had entered, his spirit had entered Saul, and he prophesied, indicating that God was with him, wasn't it? It was part of the ceremony that occurred at his anointing. And then it happens again. What's significant about it now? This is the last time that God will cause Saul to do anything. Now, God will providentially inhibit and thwart Saul's attempt to kill David, but he leaves Saul, and Saul doesn't get any more connection with God in his life. He seeks God's will, and he seeks God's advice and help, and especially in battle. And he even goes, we'll see later on, he even goes to a witch to try to get some information. But God doesn't ever answer him anymore. And I think this is the last time that God does anything to directly with Saul. So that's kind of a review of where we were, and John wanted me to kind of cover that last part. He may have some more insight into the prophecies and so on there when he gets back. Incidentally, Saul sends three groups of men to kill or capture David. There's a similar occasion in 2 Kings chapter 1 where the king of the northern tribes, after the division into Judah and Israel, the king of the northern tribes sends a group of men to capture a prophet, Elijah. And what happens? Anybody remember that story? He sends a company of men to capture him, and what does Elijah call down upon them? Remember? First chapter of 2 Kings, you might read that sometime, calls down fire upon them and destroys the whole company of men. So the king sends another group. What happens to them? Same thing. He sends a third group of men, just like Saul does here, to capture Elijah. And the captain of the third group knows what the situation is. He comes on his knees begging Elijah to spare him and his men. And Elijah goes back with him, and that's where, that's part of the story there. You'll have to read that to get the context. But anyway, that sort of thing is common. Okay. Chapter 20, verses 1 to 4. And let's read this together. David fled from Naoth at Ramah and went to Jonathan. Now, where is Jonathan, do you suppose? Well, Jonathan's where the king is at headquarters. Really, where is that? Where is King Saul headquartered? Saul is a Benjamite. He's in Gibeah, isn't he? That's where his headquarters is. So David fled, went to Jonathan, and asked, and Jonathan's there too, "What have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he's trying to take my life?" But Jonathan just doesn't understand that, does he? He says, "Never, never what? Saul's not going to take your life." Jonathan replied, "You're not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything great or small without confiding in me. Why would he hide this from me? It's not so." But David took an oath and said, now that's strong language, isn't it? "Your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said to himself, 'Jonathan must not know this or he will be grieved.' Yet as surely as the Lord lives," that's the oath, isn't it? "And as you live, there is only a step between me and death." Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you want me to do, I'll do it for you." Did you ever think about that? The attitude of a true friend? Did you ever feel that way about somebody? I hope spouses feel that way about each other. And parents and children feel that way about each other. "Whatever you want me to do, I'll do it for you." There is a limit, isn't there? What's the limit? It can't be illegal, immoral, or fattening. Right? Those were the limits, I think, that I've heard in the past. I don't know what that means. But whatever you want me to do, I'll do it for you. You feel that way about somebody? I hope you do. And I get the feeling that there's a lot of that in this congregation. That's very encouraging as a leader to look at the population and see that exhibited in the lives of the people. Whatever you want me to do. If you need some help, I'm there. Okay, let's proceed. So David said, "Look, tomorrow's the new moon festival." What's the new moon festival? Well, this is not something prescribed in the Bible itself, but it seems to have been a cultural thing. They were keeping track of the months by noticing when there's a new moon. How often does a new moon occur? Every 29 days or so, 29 to 30 days. And we just had one about 4 days ago, I think, when the moon passes the sun, and in the evening sky you see a crescent moon close to the sun. And so then they would say, okay, it's the next month when that happened. That's how they kept their calendar. And of course, we're talking about, we're not talking about an urban society. We're talking about farmers and people that are scattered all over the land. And so that keeps them sort of synchronized in keeping track of the days. So they had a festival. They're like us. Any excuse for a party, okay? So they're going to hold a festival every time there's a new moon. And that way everybody will know and get the word that we've started a new month. So tomorrow's the new moon festival. And I'm supposed to dine with the king, but let me go and hide in the field until the evening and the day after tomorrow. If your father misses me at all, tell him, David earnestly asked my permission to hurry to Bethlehem, his hometown, because an annual sacrifice is being made there for his whole clan. Incidentally, is that true? Well, we don't really know whether it's true or not. There may have been such a sacrifice. Whether or not David intended to go seems doubtful. And so he's going to use this as a ruse to try to get some information. And so Saul is unpredictable at this time, isn't he? And so if he says, very well, then your servant is safe. But if he loses his temper, you can be sure that he's determined to harm me. As for you, show kindness to your servant, for you have brought him into a covenant with you before the Lord. If I am guilty, then kill me yourself. Why hand me over to your father? Well, he's not guilty of anything, of course. Never, Jonathan said. If I had the least inkling that my father was determined to harm you, wouldn't I tell you? David asked, who will tell me if your father answers you harshly? He's going back to his plan here, isn't he? And Jonathan said, let's go out into the field. So they went there together. Then Jonathan said to David, by the Lord, the God of Israel, I will surely sound out my father by this time, the day after tomorrow. He's affirming what he's going to do with an oath here, isn't he? They do this quite a bit in this exchange. If he's favorably disposed toward you, will I not send you word and let you know? But if my father is inclined to harm you, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely. Now, we've run into that oath a number of times, and that seems to have been a cultural oath that was true. Even Jezebel uses that when she's chasing Elijah. She's not an Israelite. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I do not let you know and send you away safely. But that's an emphatic oath. May the Lord be with you as he's been with my father. That's interesting, isn't it? Because Jonathan is going to tell us here in a minute that he believes David's going to be the next king. But show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord as long as I live so that I may not be killed, and do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. And so Jonathan's telling David he's going to be the next king. We'll see that in a minute. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord call David's enemies to account. And Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him, because he loved him as he loved himself. They've become very, very close friends. So here is this covenant that they make. And particularly note verses 14 and 15, mark them in your Bible, because those will come up again later on, and let me show you how. May the Lord be with you as he's been with my father. You see, he's thinking of him as becoming the next king. In 2 Samuel chapter 9, just make a note in the margin, David asks, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? And if you go read, chapter 9 is all about the story of Mephibosheth, who was the only surviving, I think he's a grandson, of Saul. And he's son, Jonathan's son. Mephibosheth was when the Philistines overran Israel, he was gathered up by his nurse, and they were running, and she dropped him, and he was crippled in his feet throughout his life. But he was kept hidden because the general idea was that if a descendant of the previous king was found somewhere, that might be a source of conflict in the kingdom. And so normally they didn't let such individuals live. But of course David wasn't going to kill him. And David finds out about him, calls him into his household, and gives him a pension for the rest of his life. He eats at the king's table, and David cares for him and his children. So here is David in 2 Samuel chapter 9, fulfilling his oath, his promise, his covenant to Jonathan. So back to 1 Samuel 20. Then Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon." Well, we've already been there. Well, no. Tomorrow is the new moon festival. You will be missed because your seat will be empty. Remember that particular phrase. We'll come back to that in a minute. The day after tomorrow, toward evening, go to the place where you hid when this trouble began and wait by the stone Ezel. Do you name the stones in your backyard? This evidently was some kind of a marker, a boundary marker or something that had a particular name. There, previously we saw a stone that Samuel set up that was named Ebenezer. Here I raise my Ebenezer. That was a stone that was given a name because it represented a historical event, didn't it? That may be the case here. We don't know the history. I will shoot 3 arrows to the side of it as though I were shooting at a target. Then I will send a boy and say, go find the arrows. If I say to him, look, the arrows are on this side of you, bring them here, then come, because as surely as the Lord lives, you are safe. There's no danger. But if I say to the boy, look, the arrows are beyond you, then you must go, because the Lord has sent you away. And about the matter you and I discussed, remember the Lord is witness between you and me forever. What's the matter that they had discussed? The covenant, isn't it? That's still on his mind. So this is an interesting story that we teach to our children in Bible class, that David shot the arrows if they went beyond the boy who was picking them up, his servant boy. Then that meant there was trouble. If the arrows fell short of him, then that meant that was a signal that everything's okay. So David is hiding there by that stone, and he can see the signal that Jonathan is giving. But here, it evidently is safe, and so David reveals himself. Let's go back to that statement. You will be missed because your seat will be empty. I've heard sermons preached about that. Have you heard sermons preached about that? What do we mean by that in modern terms? It has to do with a habit that we have of always sitting in the same place. Do you ever think of that as being a positive thing? In fact, in the church 100, 200 years ago, often on the pews the names of the occupants were there. In fact, some of the churches were built with little cubicles around the different seats, and so this particular one would be reserved for Don and Regina Evanstadt, and this one would be reserved for so-and-so and so-and-so. So you would have a particular seat. Well, it's just about that bad here, or good here, isn't it? We always sit in the same place. And if you sit in a different place, people will notice. Have you ever had that happen to you? Well, it's a good thing. Because if your seat is empty, you'll be missed. Is that significant? Is that good that you're missed? Do you like to be missed when you're not here? Yeah, sure. You'd like to think that your presence in the congregation is significant, and that that when you're not here, people will take notes. Why? You might be sick. You might be ill. You might be in need. You might have been hurt. You might have had to take a trip because somebody else in your family was ill. And you'd like to know that people care about you that much that they will inquire and see, because you're missed when you're not here. That ought to be motivation for you to be here, too, because people will notice. Some kinds of meetings, and I've been in conferences at the hospital, and I just dreaded going. And if I found an excuse, I didn't go. And, of course, we didn't have a place to sit. And lots of times, it didn't matter whether I went or not. Nobody noticed. And that can be a good thing if it's a if it's some sort of a thing you're not particularly interested in. But that's not what we're about here, is it? In a community like this, we want to think that other people notice when we're not here. Okay, took care of that. So David hid in the field, and when the new moon festival came, the king sat down to eat. So we're going to see what happens here with this plan. Now, the plan involves a lie. David really didn't go to Bethlehem, to his father's house. And it's just a way to get a signal to him about, and a test of about Saul's attitude. Now, the king came and sat down to eat. He sat in his customary place by the wall. Why would he sit with his back to the wall? That's a good old Texas trick, isn't it? You don't want to sit by a window, and you don't want to sit with your back to the general population, because someone may sneak up on you and give you a headache or something. So he has enemies. Saul isn't really very popular at this point, and so he's taking precaution here. He sat with the back of the wall opposite Jonathan, and Abner sat next to Saul. But David's place was empty. Evidently, Abner sat on one side and David sat on the other. That's the suggestion. Saul said nothing that day, for he thought something must have happened to David to make him ceremonially unclean. Surely he is unclean. So he just drew a conclusion about David's absence and said, well, there's something wrong. We don't know what it is, but it must be unclean. Now, that assigns a religious overtone to this new moon festival that really doesn't exist as such in the Bible, that he was unclean. But the next day, the second day of the month, David's place was empty again. Then Saul said to his son Jonathan, why hasn't the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today? So he does notice. Jonathan answered, David earnestly asked me for permission to go to Bethlehem. He said, let me go because our family is observing a sacrifice in the town and my brother has ordered me to be there. It's not exactly what David said, but similar. If I found favor in your eyes, let me get away to see my brothers. That's why he has not come to the king's table. Well, that sounds reasonable, doesn't it? A sane individual would accept such an excuse for David's absence. Did you ever have trouble with excuses when you were in school? Your mother has to write you an excuse? Okay, never mind. They should always be true, incidentally. Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman. What does she have to do with anything? Oh, I see. Okay. Don't accept the responsibility. Don't put it on David. Don't I know that you've sided with... Now, he's talking to Jonathan, isn't he? Don't I know that you've sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Why? He's going to be the next king, isn't he? They know that. It's common knowledge in this household. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die. Why should he be put to death? What has he done? Jonathan asked his father. But Saul hurled his spear to kill him. Who? Jonathan. Of course, just like David, he dodged, I guess. He ducked and he didn't get hit. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger on that second day of the month. He did not eat because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. So, David's worst fears materialized in this exchange, didn't they? Yes. Yeah, I suppose that's right. He says he doesn't call him David. He calls him the son of Jesse. He just doesn't want to utter his name, does he? I guess it's just a symbol of his hatred here, and it's also part of his psychological problem. As we go deeper and deeper into the story, he's gradually devolving into a mental disease. And while we're on that subject, to have tasted of the goodness of the Lord and to fall away, what does that leave you? Those in our situation, if you've been a Christian and you turn away from that, Paul says it's practically impossible to get somebody back from that state, isn't it? When the Spirit of God, and the Spirit of God dwells in a Christian, and it just as in the case of Saul, if you do things that cause the Spirit can no longer dwell in you if you sin, and if you cause the Spirit to leave, who's going to take its place? It's going to be an evil spirit, isn't it? It's downhill from that point on. And that's the case with Saul. And I think that's really an object lesson for all ages. If God dwells within you and then you reject him, you're in really serious trouble. Pardon me? Well, there might be more than one that will come and take its place, Jesus said, didn't he? You know, he's talking about if you sweep the place clean and then, but don't fill it with something with God, then evil spirits will come right back. So here we have in verses 35 to 42 the story. They go out in the field for the meeting with David. He had a small boy with him, and he said to the boy, "Run and find the arrows I shoot." As the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the boy came to the place where Jonathan's arrow had fallen, Jonathan called out after him, "Isn't the arrow beyond you?" Then he shouted, "Hurry, go quickly, don't stop." The boy picked up the arrow and returned to his master. The boy knew nothing at all of all this. Only Jonathan and David knew. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said, "Go carry them back to town." So the boy takes the bow and arrow and arrows. Incidentally, the arrows are expensive, aren't they? It takes some effort to make arrows, and so when he's practicing, he has someone to go retrieve them all. You don't just leave them out in the field littering the countryside. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said, "Go carry them back to town." After the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone, bowed down before Jonathan three times with his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord is witness between you and me, between your descendants and my descendants forever.'" Then David left, and Jonathan went back to town. And so no wonder David was concerned about any survivors of Saul's family. When things had calmed down and he was king, then he sought out Mephibosheth to show him kindness, as he had promised Jonathan he would. And this is just, this verse is just a reassurance about the repeat of the idea of the covenant between them. And it shows also, of course, that Jonathan understood that David would be the next king. Now in chapter 21, we have this curious story. David decides he can't stay in Israel because Saul's going to be after him with a posse everywhere he goes. And so he decides to try to go to Philistine territory. And David went to Nob and to Ahimelech, the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he met him and asked, "Why are you alone? Why is no one with you? Why would it be unusual for David to travel?" Now, this Nob is close to Ramah. It's the place where the priests lived. And it'll come up again in a couple of chapters when Saul gets angry with the priests. But Ahimelech is the high priest. And why would it be curious for David to be by himself? He may be a fugitive, you see. They know that Saul doesn't particularly like David. And so David's answer, again, is a prevarication, to put it gently. What does that mean? He's not quite telling him the truth here, is he? It could be construed that way. "Why are you alone?" David answered the priest, "The king charged me with a certain matter." The gallows, I suppose. "And said to me, 'No one is to know anything about your mission and your instructions. As for my men, I've told them to meet me at a certain place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever you can find.'" Does he have men with him? Actually, he does. And we'll see that in a minute. They aren't with him at this point, but he does have some companions. I don't know where they came from or who they are. Yeah. You might. He said, "If the Nazis knock on the door and you have Anne Frank upstairs, will you tell a lie?" Okay, yeah. Sure, he has attendance. And so that's a good reason why the priest was concerned about this, wasn't it? We'll see in a minute that he did have, and I'll show you that as we get there in just a minute. Whatever you can find, he needs provisions. You see, he left in a hurry. The posse was after him, and he doesn't have any food. But the priest answered David, "I don't have any ordinary bread on hand. However, there's some consecrated bread here, provided the men have kept themselves from women." David replied, "Indeed, women have been kept from us, as usual, whenever I set out. The men's things are holy, even on missions that are not holy." Yeah, that's kind of a curious statement, isn't it? How much more so today? Not sure what he means by that. Now, he's gone to the tabernacle at Nob. It has been moved earlier in the book. We saw it at Shiloh, and then I think it went to Mizpah. And now it's moved to Nob, where the priests are. And inside this tent-like structure, it's surrounded by a courtyard. And incidentally, when it says later on he entered the house of God, he doesn't go in the tabernacle itself. Only the priests go in there. But coming into the courtyard is the equivalent of entering the house. In an ordinary house, as they built houses, they would have a walled courtyard around the house. So inside is the table of showbread and the bread of the presence. I've shown you a drawing of that to point out that these are considerable loaves. They're large, maybe 2 inches thick loaves of bread, unleavened bread, incidentally. But they're not loaves like you get from Mrs. Baird. They're flat bread, but each one probably weighs a pound or more. And so that's considerable amount of nourishment in these loaves, and there's 12 of them. The priests exchange the loaves on the table, take them away, and put fresh bread on, I think, every Sabbath, or every maybe the day before the Sabbath. So weekly they are changed that way. All right. One day, one Sabbath in Luke chapter 6, Jesus was going through the grain fields. His disciples begin to pick some heads of grain, rub them in their hands, and eat the kernels. Some of the Pharisees asked, "Why are you doing what's unlawful on the Sabbath? Why was that unlawful?" Well, it was a rule that the Pharisees had made. It wasn't anything that God had declared. Jesus answered them, "Have you not read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God." You see, he went in. He's allowed into the courtyard, but not into the tabernacle itself. And taking the consecrated bread, the priest gave it to him. The priest had already gone in and taken it out. It was in the storage. And he ate what is lawful only for the priest to eat. And he also gave some to his companions. So you see, he had companions. Jesus said he did. Then Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." And in the Matthew account of this particular event, I discovered it after I put it on the slide, he also says, "The Lord desires mercy and not sacrifice." That's something that Saul had also heard, hadn't he, from Samuel's ears, mouth. Saul's ears had heard from Samuel's mouth. So the implication is, although it wasn't the usual thing that the bread be used in this way, and God would give the bread to David to use in an emergency if he didn't have any other food. Mercy instead of sacrifice. That superseded the general rules of the use of the bread. So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, since there was no bread there except the bread of the presence that had been removed from before the Lord and replaced by hot bread on the day it was taken away. Now one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. He was Doeg the Edomite, Saul's head shepherd. Keep that in mind, because that shows up in a subsequent chapter. Doeg is not an Israelite. He's an Edomite. He's from Edom. And he was the head shepherd of Saul. David asked Ahimelech, "Don't you have a spear or sword here?" And he goes on, and the sword that they have is the sword of Goliath. And so David takes that sword, and that's his weapon. "There's none like it. Give it to me." On that day, David fled from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. So he goes to, he's been planning this, and he decides to go to Philistia so that he can be out of Saul's reach. But the servants of Achish said to him, "Isn't this David the king of the land? Isn't he the one they sing about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousands, David his tens of thousands. He's not the king of the land," but Philistines suspect he may be. And maybe they've heard he's going to be king. I don't know. David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, king of Gath. But we're going to see him come back to Achish as a welcome guest in a subsequent chapter here. But for this particular time, he pretended to be insane. And Achish said, "Look at the man. He's insane. Why bring him to me? Am I so short of madmen that you have to bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must this man come into my house? Why didn't he just kill him?" It was against their custom. You don't kill You don't kill an insane man. And we generally have that rule in our country too, don't we? So he escaped on that ruse and went elsewhere, as you'll see in the subsequent chapters. Okay, we got through pretty much on time this morning. We have some questions back there. Okay. Yeah, what does that mean, detained before the Lord? I suspect it means he had committed some sin and was having to be ceremonially cleansed in some sense. I don't know what he had done. We aren't told. Yeah, that seems kind of odd, doesn't it, that he would, but I suspect he had been caught in some way and he had pretended to repent. As we'll see, he doesn't have much in the way of repentance in him. And Susan had a point back here. They have what? Oh, yeah. It's at a Presbyterian church, I think. Which one? I still didn't understand you. Windbrook? Windwood. Okay. Presbyterian Church has a full-size replica of the tabernacle for exhibition. If anybody's interested. Is it the same one that used to be down in South Houston for a couple of weeks? We don't know. It may be. But that's an interesting thing to see. And we have a replica of the tabernacle on the second floor in front of the library, if you're interested. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.